Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we are discussing the latest developments concerning the Troy Zoning Board of Appeals and the Hillside neighborhood.
Then Corinne Carey joins us to discuss New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act.
Afterwards, correspondent Aaron Pettinati brings us an interview with Jeff Kirkpatrick, director of the Bethlehem Public Library.
And later on, we'll chat with Stanley Hatzell from Market Block Books about another stack of good reads. Let's start the show off with some headlines. Actress and activist Cynthia Nixon announced on Monday that she will challenge incumbent Governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary for governor of New York. Ms. Nixon is best known for her acting role in Sex and the City, but is also a vocal advocate of educational reform. If elected, she would be the first female and first openly gay governor of New York.
The Times Union reports that the Division of Criminal Justice Services failed to discipline a staff director despite the fact that the state inspector general found he had threatened female employees with physical violence and engaged in years of sexual harassment, racism, and ageism. Instead, the DCIS punished two women who had provided testimony about the case to the state inspector general's office. The governor's office has apparently asked the governor's Office of Employees Relations to investigate the termination of a female attorney who had testified as a witness in a sexual harassment case in 2017.
The city of Watervliet is moving ahead on a state grant to conduct a tree inventory. The city recently appointed five members to the Tree Inventory Committee and hired Davy Resource Group Incorporated to provide consulting services for the Watervliet Urban Forestry Inventory Project.
Meanwhile, the Troy City Council announced it will continue its neighborhood improvement program after receiving a gift of $12,000 from the Troy Capital Resource Corporation. Local projects can receive up to $1,000 in funding. The program had been cut from the recently passed city budget.
The City of Troy will spend $100,000 from its capital fund to repair the Knickerbocker Ice Rink, which closed in January after its ice-making machinery failed. The rink is the third major city recreation facility to be closed in 2 years due to maintenance issues.
Governor Cuomo wants to increase the background check waiting period for the purchase of firearms in New York to a maximum 10 days, the Daily News reported. He intends to make this issue a priority once the state budget is adopted.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or heartwarming praise, you can text us at 518-888-3004. A surprise legal discovery from last week could call into question nearly 30 years' worth of decisions by the Troy Zoning Board of Appeals. The Times Union reported that the legal code states that, quote, granting a variance from any requirement of this chapter shall require the concurrence of 4 members out of 5 of the Zoning Board of Appeals, close quote. However, for years, the Zoning Board had granted variances with a simple 3-2 majority. One current variance, now in play, regards a developer seeking to turn the Armenian Church in the Hillside neighborhood into RPI student housing. WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer chatted with Hillside residents Amy Halloran and Jack Magi about their resistance to the proposed development and the possible repercussions of the new legal finding.
The first thing we knew about it, I think I saw a sign up, and then a couple weeks later, we got a notice that there was this proposal before the zoning board to turn it into student housing.
And the first time the proposal came before the zoning board, they were applying for 48 to, you know, house 48 people, which is a lot more than our zoning allows. Our zoning was changed in 2015.
We wanted to make it harder for
commercial developments like this. We worked with council people, and the city council created new zoning. So our neighborhood is one of the few in the city that have updated zoning, and the application within a year and a half of the zoning getting changed, asking for a variance to that. So the first time we spoke at the meeting, we had a whole bunch of neighbors.
That was December.
And the Zoning Board of Appeals was very receptive to what we said. They were super happy that we were involved, and they were friendly. They praised our children, who were articulate about the issue, and they praised our neighborhood for being coherent in and showing up and asking for something. They told the applicant that he needed to listen to us and make a change, and they suggested that a smaller number might be. They suggested that
a smaller number of
students.
Dwelling units and students. Yeah.
The applicant is a lawyer with a prominent
local law firm, and I think he's been practicing law in this city and represents RBI actually for decades.
Yeah. We invited him over for pancakes. He brought a pie. He listened, but I don't think he heard us, because after the meeting, he sent us a proposal that was not much different. We don't want parties. We don't want trash left out all week. We don't want
a sense of transience.
Yeah, people who are not invested in being here. We've all been students, and we know what the priorities are, and they are not connecting with other people who are rooted raising families. We asked for family housing. How about making units that would appeal to families? That was one big request. And when we got the new plans, they had dropped it down to half, and that was about the only change. So the second time we went before the Zoning Board of Appeals was a very different experience than the first. The chairperson was rude to us, censored what we could and couldn't talk about, was impatient that we had an opinion, seemed to suggest that we would be impossible to satisfy, and couldn't understand why we weren't happy the guy had given change, done some change. So what do you people want? It was really stunning how unpleasant the chairperson was to taxpaying citizens. I saw a lot of my neighbors after that night, and it's just an ugly feeling to have your representatives chastise you like the head of a detention hall. It's really gross. But aside from the grossness, there is this huge threat to our quality of life. That meeting was challenging, not just because we were chastised for having an opinion, but because they did all these strange procedural wiggles that are kind of mind-blowing. As they were about to vote on things, there were two people voting to deny the application, two people voting to allow it. And it was a tie. So because it was a 2-2 scenario, we didn't have a tiebreaker zoning board at the time. At the beginning of the meeting, the applicant had the chance to wait until there were five, but they went through, they did the vote, they got to a tie, and then the applicant said, "Can we table it?" And then a lawyer who was there with the applicant, another lawyer, was consulted by the chairperson. So it was not a non-partisan lawyer. It was a lawyer with a vested interest in this. Was consulted about the legality of this move.
It just the big issue is that this just went on the market, and immediately this proposal came through. It didn't have time to be on the market and to allow other more conforming uses to be proposed. You know, nobody else had a chance to bid on the building. And that's what we'd like to have happen, basically. And, you know, if in the end nobody buys the building once it's been on the market for half a year or a year or something like that, it's like, oh, well, it's got to... Then they would have an argument that it's not marketable for anything but that purpose, but that hasn't been demonstrated so far.
So the way that they... The reason they were arguing for they deserve a variance is because of hardship. The hardship being that there's nothing else you can do with a church.
They have to demonstrate that in the application, which you've probably seen, right? So they have to say, you know, there's no feasible economic use for this building except what we're proposing. And the proof of that, in our mind anyway, and I think in our lawyers too, is that would be the market, sort of like, let capitalism figure it out, right? It's just like, it's available. Let's see if anybody else shows up and expresses interest. And that hasn't happened.
And the other proof against that argument is that just blocks from us, a former church has been renovated to become a series of artist studios. So there's this very clear demonstration that...
With the waiting list and sort of overflowing. So
you can do something profitable with a former church building.
Profitable enough to buy it. I mean, yeah. We don't care particularly about how much profit is being made.
How concerned are you that the comprehensive plan will tip things against the new zoning? I mean, it seems like things are still in a very early draft.
I haven't had a chance to read it, but my sense from the presentation was that there's an emphasis on rezoning, on getting zoning right. Whatever that means, which could be bad for individual neighborhoods, I guess. But since we already have an updated one, it's like it seemed to me that it's other parts of the city that need their zoning updated, and we might not need ours updated, hopefully. My real concern in all of this is just that we have a poorly functioning zoning board. And, you know, it should be operating with detachment, and so it just it should be deliberative, and it should be have detachment, and that doesn't seem to be the case.
Somebody went digging around, and potentially that was the result of the pressure that we were putting on, but I don't know that that's the case. I mean, the digging that happened may have been the result of the extra scrutiny that we were drawing to the case, but I'm not really sure that that's true. The law is hundreds of pages long, and it's hard to read, and there are bound to be things that conflict with one another in it, especially as it gets changed over time. So it's not that surprising to me, but you know, I'm going to wait to see if the city actually does reverse the decision. It potentially reverses lots of decisions going back 30 years. You know, anybody who had a 3-2 decision could potentially take some kind of action. It could open up some floodgates. So that's not necessarily a great thing, but it's just a weird thing. The way that the zoning board has been functioning in our fairly brief experience, both with our particular NIMBY event here, literally in our backyard, but more, I've been to a few other zoning board meetings over the past couple of years, and the way that the process is carried out doesn't seem particularly rule-bound, and as I've gotten into this process through the event in the situation in my backyard, I've come to realize that it's supposed to be a very rule-driven process, and so that it concerns me both because the proceedings were particularly uncivil at times, but also the point that I'm making about just the sort of rule-oriented or law-oriented nature of the zoning board has clearly not been happening. It seems like more of a subjective situation of, you know, do people like the idea? Do they think it's a good proposal or something like that? And that's as I'm coming to understand, that's not the function of the zoning board. I can say, from what little bit that I've heard, that it's very unusual that most zoning boards in the state, anyway, that most of them function on a straight majority basis. So, I mean, there might be an argument for making it in line with other zoning boards across the state. There also might be an argument for keeping it, making it much harder to get variances. So, I'm not sure. That, I think, shouldn't, you know, if it were up to me, I would say, let's think about that for a while and have, like, a discussion about it and not jump to a conclusion about how that should change or not change.
From what I understand, you had hired legal representation. Was that the mechanism by which this was discovered? Do you know?
I can't quite remember. It's either one of our neighbors or somebody on the city council or somebody. I can't quite remember how it first emerged, this bit of law that emerged. It's still kind of amazing. One, you know, I mentioned that there could be potentially people who also got 3-2 votes who would go back and ask for a review of their case or a change in the outcome of their case. And there was one that seems kind of similar to ours, but I think more egregious in some ways, which was a development on Oakwood Avenue. Which was heard at the same night as ours, so the beginning of March, a week ago now, and that was also decided on a 3-2 vote, and so I'm thinking that proposal also will be or has been reversed. That decision probably has been reversed already, and so that's a big deal for that neighborhood because they worked pretty hard as well to oppose it, and it took a very long time to finally make it through and get voted on. And so I'm really hoping that neighbors across the city, you know, citizens across the city will see the importance of participation in government. I'm hoping it's a way that will bring people together, especially from different neighborhoods and within neighborhoods. So that's the sort of the most exciting part about it to me.
That was WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer chatting with Hillside residents Jack McGuy and Amy Halloran about the Zoning Board of Appeals. The next Troy Zoning Board of Appeals meeting will be held Tuesday, April 3rd at 6 p.m.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
Our first guest today is Corinne Carey, the campaign director of New York Compassion and Choices. Corinne is here to talk about New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act that is currently pending in the state legislature. Welcome, Corinne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Can you tell us a little bit about the mission of the Organization for Compassion and Choices?
Compassion and Choices is the nation's oldest, largest, and most active nonprofit working to improve care and expand choices at the end of life. We've been around for over 30 years. We support families when they have a loved one who's dying, and we try to improve policies by passing laws.
So the policies must have changed drastically over time, but there's a significant piece of legislation, the Medical Aid in Dying Act. What is that piece of legislation all about?
So the bill that is pending in the New York State Legislature right now is modeled after a 1994 law adopted in Oregon called the Death with Dignity Act. The Medical Aid in Dying Act would allow someone who's terminally ill and determined to be within 6 months of death, able to make their own medical decisions, to ask a doctor for a prescription that they can take at a time of their choosing, should their suffering become unbearable at the end of life. The bill has a number of safeguards that ensure that it's an autonomous decision. So, for example, someone has to be able to administer the medication to themselves.
Other than Oregon, are there other states that are that have already passed this bill?
There are six. Involved? Yeah, six states now authorize the practice of medical aid in dying.
Offhand, what they are?
I do. Oh. Oregon was the first. Montana approved medical aid in dying for its residents through a court decision in 1998. And then Washington State passed it through a ballot referendum. Colorado followed. California passed it in 2015. And Washington, D.C. passed it as well through its city council, and it went into effect last year.
And how is the bill I mean, since 1994, there must be a lot of data about how that's proceeded since then.
There is a lot of data. It's a law that's been under a microscope from a public policy perspective. And so each year, the Oregon Department of Public Health issues a report. The latest one, year 20, just came out at the beginning of February. And it showed that just under 2,000 people received a prescription in 20 years for the medication. And only about a third of them ever took it. You know, over a third put the medication in the medicine cabinet, report feeling that there's peace of mind that they feel, knowing that there's a way out should their suffering become too much to bear, and over a third never use it.
And the very fact that they have that ability to choose to end their lives, that reduces their stress and sometimes makes it more easy to
it
go?
It does. It does. It's sort of paradoxical in a way. Some people report being more willing to engage in experimental treatments, more willing to engage in another round of chemotherapy or radiation or immunotherapy, knowing that if those treatments are too harsh and make them, diminish their quality of life and their suffering becomes too great, that there's a door, a way out.
So given the number of states that have done this so far and the progress that we're seeing in New York at this point, would you describe this as a movement?
I think it is a movement. Some of your listeners may have heard the name Brittany Menard. She was a 29-year-old woman from California who was diagnosed with a brain tumor at 29 years old, shortly after she was married. And she did what everyone who's diagnosed with cancer does. She asked her doctor, how can we beat this? And when the aggressive treatment that she received resulted in a larger, more aggressive brain tumor, she said, when the time comes, will you help me die? And her doctor said, no, it's illegal here in California. And at the time, it was. Well, she went to People magazine and shared her story with the world. It actually became the most watched video on People magazine's website. She told her story of suffering and her desire to have some control over the end of her life. 29 state legislatures responded with bills the following year, and New York was one of them. So more and more people are looking at Brittany's story and becoming inspired to share their own stories, either of their own terminal illness or of loved ones who've passed after needless suffering.
How did Brittany's story end?
She and her husband had the resources and the wherewithal to move to Oregon. So she upended her life and established a new care team in the state of Oregon, rented an apartment on Craigslist, and she qualified and received the prescription. She put the drugs in her medicine cabinet and went about living the rest of her life. She went to Alaska, she went to the Grand Canyon, and she also advocated for changes to the law. So she spoke with lawmakers in California and with the governor, and I think in her honor, the state legislature passed the bill the year after she died.
How do you see this issue affecting other issues within the healthcare system?
I think it doesn't really affect other issues in the healthcare system. We have a broken healthcare payment system right now, and I think everyone knows that. Medical aid in dying doesn't have any impact on that. It just gives people who are dying one more option. Right now, if you're dying in the state of New York, there are few options available to you. Certainly, hospice and palliative care have improved the lives of the last days of the lives of people who are dying in this state, and provided relief to countless other family members. But when suffering becomes too great, particularly when someone has different forms of cancer, there should be another option. And so this just adds another tool to healthcare providers who are caring for the dying.
Have there been any studies conducted about the about this type of I'm blanking on the
end of life option?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
There have been many studies, studies of the effect that this has on family members. Certainly, as it has allowed people to plan the end of their lives and to say their goodbyes to their family members, to have a celebration of their lives instead of having loved ones sit at the hospital bed and watch someone deteriorate. And so it has improved the grieving process for family members who are able to say those goodbyes to a conscious loved one before they die. There have also been each year, in every state that's authorized medical aid in dying, the health department has to report to the state legislature, and groups are paying attention to those reports and looking out for any cases of abuse or misuse or coercion. And there have been no cases. So I think that's one thing that people look at this law that was revolutionary when it passed in 1994, and it's worked. It's never had to be amended or altered or tinkered with to work better. It's the same law that's existed, and every state that's adopted it since has followed the Oregon model.
What is the stance of the medical profession, doctors, for instance? How do they feel about it?
An increasing number of doctors are supportive of medical aid in dying. There's a Medscape poll that's done of physicians online every year, and the percentages are increasing each year. So right now, 57% of doctors in this poll have indicated that they support giving patients this right. Just in the past 18 months, 10 state medical societies have dropped their opposition to aid in dying. And I think it's because they're looking at the evidence and they're seeing that this works. Very few people use medical aid in dying, but it provides a comfort to countless others.
This may seem like a very personal question, and it is, of course, but how did you become involved with this particular issue?
So I used to work with the New York ACLU for about a decade, and my father was diagnosed with lung cancer, and we were able to access hospice services just in the last 48 hours of his life, which is far too late for an individual or a family member to gain the true benefits that hospice can provide. So I started thinking a lot about death and dying at that point, and it was right around that time that Brittany Menard was on the national stage, and this just seemed to be a worthwhile issue to get involved with.
Yeah, my own dad passed last July. He had ALS, and he was a veteran, had been in the Navy, so he had access to the VA. And without that hospice care, I can't imagine. I mean, it was grueling enough on my mom as it was, but without that, there's just no way.
Yeah, my dad was a vet too. He was a tough guy. He didn't even want pain medication in the end. But hospice provides much more than pain medication. It really helps the family deal with the caregiving that you need to do at the end of life.
That whole unit, the palliative care unit, I mean, there are the people who go there and they pass there, and the relatives that and friends that come to support them. But the staff that's there, and they just see this over and over again. We got to be friends with some of the nurses, and one of them actually transferred out of palliative care after that, partially because she became attached to my dad. Just that was kind of like a straw breaking the camel's back, you know, when it was impersonal enough with the other people passing through. But once you start to become friends with somebody, and it's just boom, boom.
Yeah. So, in other ways, being around people who are dying is almost spiritual, you know, is allowing people to have a peaceful and loving send-off. So I really admire the work of hospice providers in that way.
So, sorry, go ahead.
Where can folks go to find out more about the bill?
Sure. We've got a Facebook page. It's Compassion and Choices New York, and we announce activities and public education programs and lobby days. We have a lobby day coming up on April 23rd here in the Capital Region at the Capitol. So we hope that people who agree with this check us out on Facebook and join us in Albany on April 23rd.
Great. And is there anything else that you would like us to know?
Well, I just think, you know, medical aid in dying is not for everyone. And so you may have some listeners that are sitting there saying, well, no, this isn't for me at all. And I think what's important to realize is that the bill wouldn't change anything for people who oppose medical aid in dying, but it would open up this choice to people who may see some benefit to it and may need it at the end.
Great. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Corinne Carey, the New York Compassion and Choices Campaign Director, informing us on New York's Medical Aid and Dying Act. You can learn more about this campaign at compassionandchoices.org. Thanks for joining us again, Corinne.
Thanks for having me.
For those just tuning in, I'm J.P. Bogorski.
And I'm Dave Pablo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or an urgent warning, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Recently, WOOC correspondent Aaron Pednotti spoke with Jeff Kirkpatrick, director of the Bethlehem Public Library. They spoke about changes at the public access television station run by the library.
I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I am interviewing Jeffrey Kirkpatrick, the director of the Bethlehem Public Library, about Bethlehem Cable TV. Jeff, thanks for sitting down for this interview. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So to start out, can you give us some basic information about Bethlehem Cable TV? What is it and what kind of programming does it provide?
So the Bethlehem Community Network Television is the public access channel that serves the most directly serves the town of Bethlehem. So it's always public access TV is a little bit of a hard thing to get your hands around, right? Sometimes they don't necessarily have the kind of organizations where you hold them can change, right? So, but libraries are frequently holders of the cable access channels, and in Bethlehem, the library happens to be the holding location.
I see. And in terms of coverage, does it have a specifically local focus, or is it a general topic programming channel?
The channel is interesting. So it does have a local focus, though we play shows that come from all over the country, but obviously, the priority goes to programs of local interest. So when we're looking mostly at scheduling, it's the programs that are local that we would play first, that get the primary time slots. Mm-hmm. And then shows that come from around the rest of the state or around the country get put on at different time slots.
I see. So there's a kind of prioritization of the local.
Correct. Yeah.
And what sort of topics tend to come up on the channel?
So, and again, the TV station is different than a lot of other TV stations because we don't control the content, right? It's public access television. This is an access outlet for people to for the citizens to be able to play shows that are important to them. So our shows tend to be all over the place. There's we certainly show the board meetings, the local board meetings from school districts and the town, several town different board meetings, the Zoning Board of Appeals, the town board itself, mm-hmm. School districts. We show board meetings from three different school districts that touch on the town of Bethlehem. And then we'll there'll be the religious programs where a lot of the local churches will film their services and we show them. The Albany Diocese films a show and we show those. And then there are shows that are traditionally sort of like community-focused shows that people are just sort of very, very interested in their community and they want to have those shows aired on their local cable channels.
So do you have regular content producers who produce on a weekly or monthly basis?
So yes. And again, there's a separation between what gets aired on the channel, and then what gets produced in our studio. So right now, the studio, we're under HVAC renovations, so the studio is offline. But that doesn't mean the channel's offline. So we're continuing to show content that is produced outside the library and then sent to the library, you know, sent to the channel, and then we show that content.
I see. And what's the channel's formal relationship to Bethlehem Public Library and also to the town of Bethlehem?
Sure. So again, it's PEG Television. It's public education and government. This channel happens to be the public channel, but it operates a little bit with some education content and some government content too. Mm-hmm. The formal relationship is there isn't much of a formal relationship. This is kind of a handshake agreement that has been around for quite a while. So the funds for the capital – so when we're talking about equipment, things that would have to be purchased, equipment or construction to the studio itself, that money comes through the town of Bethlehem and the cable franchise fee through a subscriber-based fee that gets paid every month for the cable subscribers on the two different providers in the town of Bethlehem. So there's Verizon and Spectrum. And the subscribers every month, there's a small fee on their bill, and that money gets collected by the cable companies, turned over to the town of Bethlehem, and then that money actually goes to three different places potentially to buy equipment. So the three different places that money can go for equipment purchases can be to the town itself, to the town board if they want to film, you know, for the purposes of filming the town board meetings, zoning board meetings. It can go to the Bethlehem School District for the purpose of filming their board meetings. And again, that gets showed on the channel. Mm-hmm. And then it can come to the library for buying all of the equipment, not only to film things in the library, but also to operate the channel itself, schedule programs, that sort of thing. So then the library half is that it's housed by the library, right, obviously. And then any staff people are paid for, are library employees. So it's paid for out of the library. And it's a service industry, right? So the staffing is the most expensive part of any of those things. So the library contributes the lion's share of the money towards the endeavor.
So it's a pretty tight relationship with the library.
It's not a separate entity. It is a department of the library. Not even a formal department. It's a piece of the library. It's a service that the library offers. It is governed by the library trustees. So they are the governing board that runs this. But again, as far as a formal agreement between the town and the school district and the library, there isn't one. But it's worked. It's worked along for a long time. So
can you tell us a bit about the history of Bethlehem Cable TV? First of all, how did the idea for it arise?
Right. So this is deep into the past as far as public access TV is concerned. At one point in the town, before 82, it was housed outside the library. So on Delaware Avenue, if you're familiar with Delmar, they had a office space that was rented and the studio was run out of that. At some point, because again, the money that comes through the franchise can only be used for capital and again, not staff, it became difficult for the organization to continue to run. So they were reaching out to different local agencies and asking about, you know, where we might house this to provide it with some level of stability and support, right? That's the challenge when you're talking about setting up a public access television station. Who pays the staffing costs? Mm-hmm. So at that point, we went to the board of directors. I can only assume at that point. I haven't looked at the minutes. And they agreed at that time to bring it into the library, use those capital funds to construct, to take an old storage room and turn that into the studio, and then bring make another area into the control room, and then that the staff would come from the library's budget.
I see. And how long has it been around? What's the timeline for all of that?
In the library, at least since 1982.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And can you tell us about some of the challenges and rewards of being involved in a local public access channel?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of challenges and rewards. The best part is that this is truly, there are not that many outlets for free speech, right? So this is one. Again, we're not trying to control content. We're trying to make this an access vehicle, a way for people to get their voices heard on their local cable stations, right? That's what the purpose of this is for. So that is very rewarding. So people who are super community oriented and want to produce a show, we create an outlet for them to do that. That's extremely rewarding. Can be complicated is this nature of the relationship between the town and the school district and the library with no real formal agreement. It works and it has worked for years, obviously, if it's been around since 1982. But it's a complex relationship. And I think just explaining to people, what is this? How does it actually operate? And then what's the purpose of that? And then trying to broaden the base of who are the people who want to participate in this. And then add another layer on top of that, technology is changing the way in which people consume media all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And recently, this is the biggest challenge that we're facing right now.
Like how people actually access the channel?
Well, that is a change, right? So we'll talk about Spectrum for a minute. They just switched the public access channels, certainly in Bethlehem, to the digital tier. So people who in the course of the history, the channel has been on channel 31, channel 17, and channel 18 most recently. And then when we switched to the digital tier, it went to channel 1301, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is a little bit buried. And people were saying, you know, where's the channel? And we say, oh, it's on channel 1301. And then for a while, it was digital on some TVs if they had a certain tuner, if they didn't have a certain tuner. It was confusing to try to explain to people instead of just saying, it's on channel 18, that's where it is. So that's a technological issue that's just confusing about cable, the cable broadcast itself. Add into the complexity of in the local area, Bethlehem is one of the places that has a second cable network that people can sign on to for Verizon Fios TV. And then what channel is that on? And then people don't frequently know. Sometimes they don't even know which cable subscriber, which cable provider they have. And we have to talk them through that sort of on a case-by-case basis. So I think certainly the number of people that can stumble by the channel serendipitously has decreased because of the placement of those channels. So there's one. Mm-hmm. And then two is a lot of people are consuming media online, right? Mm-hmm. So the money that comes for capital is to provide broadcast on cable television. Well, that's a narrowing field, right? That's not necessarily, if you were going to come up with a local interest television station, you want to call it that, and get that out to the maximum number of people, you might or might not choose cable as your medium of choice, right? There are other media available. And so that's a challenge too, right?
Right. So with those issues in mind, what do you envision for the future of Bethlehem Public TV?
Right. So we're just embarking on a pretty exciting change. So we are, after this renovation that we're going through in the library, the plan is to come back and have a studio that's going to be based on a technology called a one-button studio. So this is going to enable people to create their content largely without intervention from the staff. So the room can be used. People come in, can film a show, out of which they might put that show on the channel. They might come to us and say, please, I want this played on the channel. Fantastic. It might also be that a student wants to use that space to film themselves for a school project and then look at how they, you know, time their presentation out and look at it. So we're looking at that studio space as how can people create AV content and use that space more hours of the week. And that's the sort of we're doing that through a separation of like, what is the channel? And then what is the studio? Right. For so long, they've been conflated, and we're separating those two things out.
And is there any gesture towards moving in a direction of kind of cross-platform distribution of your content?
Right. But again, yes. I mean, so right now already, we give a copy of the show that gets produced for the producers. If they had produced it in our studio, they get a copy, and lots of the producers put them up online. But the content isn't, in the end, the station's content. The content belongs to the individual. So they are certainly distributing it in lots of different ways, but it's not the station's content to be distributing. So there is some content that is the library's content. So we'll film a program. We have an author came in. We had a Hamilton program recently. So we're filming the Hamilton program, and we absolutely take that and then distribute it online as well as having it on the channel. So that is content that belongs to the station or the library, however you want to say that. But because much of the content isn't ours, there's lots of online video platforms, any one of them. We don't have a channel specifically for that.
So that's a kind of complicated situation.
It is, because we don't own it, right? It's owned by the individual producers.
Right. Well, Jeff, thanks again for this interview. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
That was WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati speaking with Jeff Kirkpatrick, director of the Bethlehem Public Library, about changes at the public access television station run by the library.
And now it's Monday. Stanley Hatzel from the Market Block Books is here in the studio with us to talk about more great reading material. Hi, Stanley.
Good evening.
Do we have a theme this week?
I am talking about poetry and I'll say in air quotes, children's poetry, but this really is poetry for everybody. Okay.
Okay.
I don't know about how you experienced poetry, but in my education, I only had one teacher, and she was a substitute who only gave a positive spin to poetry, so I never had really good exposure to poetry. Hmm. And as a rule, I find poetry to be the hardest thing to get people interested in.
So are you saying that every teacher that you had, with the exception of this one substitute teacher, put a negative spin on poetry?
If they mentioned it at all. I had almost no poetry experience in 12 years of public school.
Wow.
But I had one eighth grade teacher who filled in for a month for Abraham Lincoln. He looked like Abraham Lincoln, my teacher.
And I always thought that poetry had a rhyme.
Right,
that's what
right.
I learned in school.
So you're going to learn today that it does not. So I brought books from the children's section of the store, and I hate to say children, and I want to say young readers, but these books really read like books any adult would want to read. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting with that premise and trying to get people to look at poetry differently. The first book I want to talk about is by Naomi Shihab Nye, who was born in Ferguson, Missouri, long before Ferguson was famous for what it is now, and then moved to Texas. Her father is from Palestine. Her mother is from Missouri. And so she has become one of my favorite poets from a long time ago. And I have this this love affair with her poetry. And she used to come to Emma Willard here in Troy. And when I was working in the Albany store, one of the teachers told me she was in town for the week, and I told them how much I loved Naomi Shihab Nye. And she came to the bookstore to meet me.
Cool.
Sadly, I didn't know she was coming, so I didn't bring any books to sign. But when she got back to Texas, she mailed me a letter with book plates that I could put her signature in my book. So she's pretty cool in my estimation.
Definitely, definitely.
So this first book is called Voices in the Air, Poems for Listeners. And I kind of tagged a couple of places here. I really like the way she writes. And this this first poem is called Gratitude Pillow. And I'm sorry Tatiana's not here, because this is a poem about...
She's listening.
Are you listening, Tatiana? Because this is about Maya Angelou. And the quote at the beginning is from Maya Angelou. She says, "Let gratitude be the pillow upon which you kneel." And the poem goes like this. Maya loved the jingle of the massive key ring carried by cable car conductors. First woman in the San Francisco trolley uniform. She liked the shiny buttons on the jacket, appreciated the swoops and dips of the routes, sharp curves, corners, bustling avenues. Clinking coin dispenser latched to her belt. She'd be a conductor all her life, write and talk, take people everywhere out of their tight little rooms. And if anyone told her they were going to Gloomy Street, she'd say, "What? Lift those eyes. Take a look at the sea to your right. Buildings full of mysteries, schools crackling with joy, open porches. Watch the world whir by. We are given without having to own, and shake that gloom right out of your system. Hope is the only drink you need to be drinking. Jingle, jingle, step right up."
That's
so
great.
I
didn't hear a single rhyme.
No, poems do not have to rhyme. And then there's another series of poems. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's rather long, but the title of the poem is called "Tell Us All the Gossip You Know." And it's excerpts from rumors or gossip about other poets. So she says here, "Robert Bly said writing a bad poem before breakfast every day is a good habit. He did it in honor of his old friend Bill Stafford, who also did it and he did this writing after Bill died. The poems were never bad, by the way. They were great. There were a lot of them. You could work on them later after you ate." And then she has this little piece about Walt Whitman. "Anyone can visit Walt Whitman's birthing corner on Long Island. The guide points and says, 'There, right there, he was born.' Some visitors can't move on quickly to the next room. They are hypnotized. What if Walt had never left this corner or stepped out onto the streets to do all that he said and did? Then who would we be?" So Naomi Shihab Nye has a bunch of books. This is her brand new this year called Voices in the Air. I highly recommend it. You won't find a single rhyming poem in there.
with that first poem especially, there's sometimes when I'm listening to poetry or especially when I'm reading it and this is one of the reasons why you have to do these things several times,
right.
You know, because you can get lost in the words themselves and in the rhythm of them and the assonance and alliteration and all those other things. Or sometimes that disappears and you enter, you know, you have the visions, you have the imagery and the all that kind of stuff that just pops into your mind.
You know, there are different ways I've approached reading poetry or reading it aloud versus reading it just visually. I think seeing it on the page for me makes a completely different experience than hearing it read. But I like the randomness of it being read aloud. Then I kind of latch onto a word that, now what was that whole phrase? I don't know the whole phrase. I can't remember the whole phrase. But it does spark that imagination. And that's why I think reading out loud is so important. And that's why she calls this Poems for Listeners. Mm. I think it really requires being read aloud. So I have listened to poets who read their poetry purposefully and repeat the lines with emphasis. And I like that, but I don't do it like that. So, so bear with me and come by the store and look at the books.
And next up is?
The next book is called Breathe and Be. It's a book of mindfulness poems. Now, it really looks like a children's picture book. You know, there's trees, there's a couple of kids in the tree, there's a moon up there. But these poems really are pieces of meditation. These poems are meant to calm you down. These poems are meant for you to be more mindful and to pay attention.
First page looks like a color vision test.
Yeah, it's a very bright and colorful book. Everything about this book is gorgeous. So it's written by Kate Coombs and illustrated by Anna Emilia Leitinen. Sorry if I butcher your name. So this one is one of those poems. This whole book is like this. You really want to take this so slowly. And here's how it starts. How I rush, rush, rush. Thoughts flutter and dart like birds. Slow down, thoughts. Come quietly with me. There is time to breathe and be. Slow down, thoughts. Come quietly with me. There's time to breathe and read. If you were to just not know that I was talking about children's books, you wouldn't think that either of these were children's books, that they'd be shelved in the children's section. And as a result, I think they don't get the attention they deserve. But this Breathe and Be is such a beautiful book. And you can just sit that book in your lap and just read a line and just take time to savor everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Do either of you meditate?
Mm-hmm.
I've done some, yeah.
So this would be the precursor to a period of meditation, just reading one of those poems. And so I had the good luck years ago to be able to teach fourth grade for one year, and it was a blast. And my students were the kind of students who were pushed onto the next grade, and they weren't really ready for fourth grade, most of them, maybe a couple were. So I was trying to figure out how to get these kids excited about reading. So I brought this next book into the classroom. This is 1986. This book was written in 1974, and it's called Where the Sidewalk Ends, and it's poems and drawings by Shel Silverstein, and anybody who has kids knows this book probably. And the reason the fourth graders liked it so much because there are words that you don't normally get to say in the classroom. You know, things like boogers and farts and a few other things. Yeah. You know, and the kids would pick the poem, and every day we'd start the class with a poem. So they would choose.
Make sure we'll be able to use them on the air.
Oh, these are kid appropriate, so they're safe for the air as well. So this first poem is called Pancake, and this is an homage to Amy Halloran out there who is obsessed with pancakes, and why not? Who wants a pancake, sweet and piping hot? Good little Grace looks up and says, I'll take the one on top. Who else wants a pancake fresh off the griddle? Terrible Teresa smiles and says, I'll take the one in the middle.
Oh, rhyme.
And there's a big old stack of pancakes. Mm-hmm. And there's your rhyme, JP.
Now I can go to sleep.
So Shell Silverstein will do a lot more rhyming. And this is probably his most famous one that I never knew he did until we read this in the fourth grade. And it's called Boa Constrictor. And it's, I'm being eaten by a boa constrictor, a boa constrictor, a boa constrictor. I'm being eaten by a boa constrictor, and I don't like it one bit. Do y'all know that poem?
I don't know that one.
I've heard it, but I heard it as an adult.
Well, what do you know?
It's
nibbling my toe.
Making me think of Cat Stevens for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard it.
Moon Shadow?
Yes, I think this has been made into a song, actually. So that's a quintessential I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to leave you hanging on that one and see where the boa constrictor ends up. So this is the poem I wanted to read that every fourth grader loved. It's called Hat. Teddy said it was a hat, so I put it on. Now Dad is saying, where the heck's the toilet plunger gone? And there's Teddy wearing the toilet plunger on his head. That gets lots of squeals.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So I want to run quickly to I'm not going to do this justice it deserves, but this is Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. It's actually an autobiography, but the whole thing is written in poetic style. It's all poetry, and it starts out from the day of her birth in February 12th, 1963, and she says, I am born on a Tuesday at University Hospital, Columbus, Ohio, USA, a country caught between black and white. I am born not long from the time or far from the place where my great-great-grandparents worked the deep, rich land, unfree, dawn till dusk, unpaid, drank cool water from scooped-out gourds, looked up and followed the sky's mirrored constellation to freedom. And that's how she starts. It is such a beautiful book. And again, it's hiding in the children's section, but really it could easily be in the adult section.
Hiding in the... Yeah.
I say hiding. It's not really hiding.
I know. I'm just thinking in terms of, you write a children's book, you're reaching future audiences that are ever expanding. So it's a very smart thing to do.
So I want to skip over to this next book, which is the title of a very famous song that everybody knows unless you're maybe 12 or 13 or 14. It's called Singing in the Rain, and it's based on the song by Arthur Freed and Nacio Herb Brown, and the pictures are by Tim Hopgood. This is super, super colorful, fun, and if I was in a singing mood, I would sing the book to you, but it's basically, I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling. I'm happy again. Now, I don't know. I look at this book, and I remember being that kid who ran out as soon as it started raining and would splash in every puddle I saw and love, and even to this day, I'm 64, I still love going for a walk in the rain and occasionally will splash in the puddle if I'm wearing the right shoes. Singing in the rain, you're going to want that.
Mm-hmm.
How's my time?
You got about a half minute.
Half a minute. I'm going to jump quickly to Sandra Boynton, who used to write greeting cards for Shoebox Greetings. You remember those funny things? Probably long before you were coherent. But this is the fifth series of books. She takes her children's books and writes songs to them. Hmm. And each book comes with a CD. So there's this one. There's Blue Moo and so many fun books. We play them in the store. We laugh. We sing along. My favorite is a song that says, I need a nap, which usually comes at about 3:30.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the need for the nap. I don't get the nap. So Poetry Month is next month. So this is me getting a head start on Poetry Month. Please read more poetry because your life is poetry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming, Stanley.
You're welcome.
Be back again next week, right?
Right.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or the sudden urge to express your gratitude, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
And as a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights. That's in about 2 minutes, at 7.07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.